Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. For over 38 years, Northern Californians were treated to one of the best meteorologists on television, Bill Martin. In his Emmy-winning career at KTVU Channel 2 in Oakland, Bill delivered forecasts with a knack for getting the nuances of weather in a complex and varied region. And he did it with charm, wit, and a relatability that made him a welcome part of our living rooms. Bill was awarded the highest certification for a TV meteorologist from the American Meteorological Society, and he's also an Emmy Award winner. He covered big stories like the Oakland Hills Fire, the Camp Fire that catastrophically burned his hometown of Paradise, and during 2011, the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. During that event, it was Bill Martin that convinced his colleagues to stay on the air and cover what was both a tragedy and an epic earth science story. The intrepid meteorologist used his science background to explain to viewers what they were seeing on live TV. Nowadays, though Bill is retired from television, he's still actively sharing his passion for weather on his YouTube channel. It's part weather forecast and all love letter to the natural beauty of California. One other thing about Bill, he also loves surfing. When he announced his retirement, world-renowned North Shore surfer Jamie O'Brien and his wife Tina even sent a video congratulating him and wishing him well. Bill joins us now from his home in the Bay Area. Bill Martin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thanks, Dave. That means a lot coming from you. I love what you guys are doing over here. And, you know, I did just retire after like 38 years of Bay Area television, the chief meteorologist of Channel 2, big blowtorch of a station, as you know.
I mean,
we had millions of viewers a night. And now there's all these different platforms and all these different opportunities to for people to express themselves. It's a drag for TV. It was a good run while it lasted, but it's also awesome to see this proliferation of community, like you guys are up in Red Bluff and Chico area, Northern California. I mean, a voice, right? It's awesome.
Let's go back in time, because I want to know about your roots, because we share those roots. Paradise, California. Tell me a little bit about what it was like for you growing up in Paradise, and what your family was like, and what your dad did. Because I know, you know, you have a love of the outdoors, as I do, and that place will definitely, especially when we were growing up, like when I was in my first time in Paradise, there was one traffic light, and that was on Skyway and Pearson.
It's actually Skyway and Wagstaff. That was the first one. I mean, I'm pretty sure. I don't want to bust on you there, but because I watched them put in the first one, right?
Could be. I just remember, you know, there were no traffic lights.
Yeah, there weren't. Your point is well taken, because we watched them put it on and we were so excited. We this sounds kind of like we're rubes, but I remember riding our Stingray bikes over to and parking at the Shell gas station on the corner and watching the lights change. I mean, it's like a movie, but yes, that's the first stoplights. That was the first one we had in town. And maybe it was Pearson, but it was one of either Wagstaff and Skyway or Pearson and Skyway. But either way, I lived on Pearson Road. Dad was a veterinarian, the first veterinarian in the community, the second veterinarian to come out of Davis. So that was right when after World War II. To get into vet school, you just had to say, I want to be a veterinarian, because they didn't have them. That was not a thing. So the vet school opened up. Dad was a second class in. He was a World War II vet. He's still alive. He's 98 years old. I'm going to go see him tomorrow.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Oh, it's awesome. And the best thing is the stories, right? So I got 98-year-old man who moved to where you guys are for lifestyle. It's so awesome. He moved up there to fish and hunt and ski. And so he moved to Paradise. You're on the Feather River Canyon. You're on the Butte Creek Canyon. So the fishing was off the charts back then. The salmon were still aggressively running up the Feather River, believe it or not. This is before Orville Dam. And they were running up. Obviously, they still move through Butte Creek. So he was a lifestyle guy. And he was awesome.
Where did he come from originally, where he decided, you know, to go to Paradise?
He was West Portal in San Francisco and was an Avenue kid. My family goes way back. We go back. I'm very proud of this. We go back five. I'm fifth generation Northern California. and my kids are six. So that puts us right at the gold rush right after. And most of my relatives came over, both sides of my mom and dad came over on wagon trains or ox carts. And so we go way back in the state. They're outdoorsmen, you know, farmers, raced horses, just agrarian society folk. With a lot of history in the state. And so dad was born that way, raised that way. They used to go, listen to this, Dave. Dad's dad was a teacher. They would take summers off. And this was a normal thing to do. They would, in the summers, they would go drive their cars if they could, or before that, they would pull wagons into Yosemite.
Yep.
On those dirt roads. And they would spend the whole summer.
Yep.
And dad goes, I go, Dad, was there anybody there? He goes, oh yeah, it was packed. He goes, the San Francisco would empty out, right? They had these abilities to do these things. And the stories he tells and the pictures I have of him in Yosemite in 1920, 1922 or what have you, or his dad's dad there in 1800s, amazing. So that's dad's story. And I was raised by that guy.
Those are the origins of the Sierra Club.
Absolutely. And I was raised by these people. And so the best thing that ever happened to me was having a dad who didn't follow the main path the light took a lifestyle job. So when I got out, I went to Berkeley, and then I got my graduate degree at Atmospheric Science at San Francisco. And I was like, well, I really like to surf. I like to do all this stuff, ski, whatever, all the stuff we all like to do. So I'm gonna do something nobody does. And at that point, there weren't many people in real meteorologists, because I was one of the first real meteorologists. And I can't even quantify it. I think I was probably one of the first, maybe in the country, to be in a big market. Meteorology, because back then, if you can remember, Dave, it was kind of, this is derogatory, but there were weather bunnies and there were comedians. The guy whose job I took at Channel 2, Pat McCormick, was a puppet guy. He did weather before I did.
It's like George Carlin. Hey, man, I'm the hippy dippy weatherman.
Exactly. They were all kind of, it was entertainment, I think. Except Harry Geis and Chico, you probably remember him.
Yes.
He was solid. But there weren't many of those. I don't know if Harry had his degree in meteorology. But anyway, I was an anomaly. I wasn't good at TV, but I was good at being outside and I was good at liking weather. And that worked, and I fell into the right place. And so all the guys like the Pat McCormick and the puppeteers, those guys were entertainers. I wasn't, but because I was I was the opposite of that. It resonated, and that it was just lucky timing. In 1982, the El Nino, because that was if you remember 82, big El Nino, big flooding, big problems. A lot of deaths in California from that year. The weather bunnies and the comedians got washed out. Well, lo and behold, that's about when I show up right after, because all of a sudden you've got weather that's life-threatening and you have these people, this very beautiful woman or this very beautiful man who's a comedian or a magician doing weather. People all of a sudden were like, no, this is serious business in California. California weather was not taken seriously, really, in my mind. Well, Harry Geis and Pete Giddings, and then 1982 hits. And that's when I was at school at Berkeley studying under Ormond Granger, who's a world-renowned climatologist. And he was talking about El Nino, one of the first times that those were being understood. This was the first one that we ever really studied in 1982. So my timing on everything was pretty awesome.
So you mentioned surfing. And, when I think of paradise, I don't think of surfing. But you definitely love surfing, as did I. I was fortunate to grow up in Malibu in the 60s, and I was around the surf culture there. And like my brother-in-law, Michael Donahue, God love him, he's still alive and still loves the ocean, true waterman. His brother, Corb, was a record company executive, and he's the guy that signed Jimmy Buffett, who is another true waterman, loves surfing, loved boating, all of it. So that culture, like Mickey Dora, people like that, that Malibu Point Break, I was around that as a child growing up, and that was...
Did you bump into Dora?
I don't. I probably did, but I know like my my brother-in-law Michael and my sister Pamela. Certainly, they, you know, they would go out to, you know, he would be there for dinner and do some goofy thing. But anyway, so that,
that's huge, though, by the way, just for those listening, especially up in the Valley, because a lot of, I know a lot of folks don't surf, but Malibu in the 60s.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. I mean, that you talk about Lance Carson, Dora. I mean, all those, I can't, Johnny Fane, you had so many, and Hollywood was down there, and Hollywood was using all these surf guys for movie extras. It was awesome. It was just a, that's an amazing time to be down there. Sorry to digress.
That's okay. But I want to know how you got into surfing.
I was, used to ski a lot growing up. We used to go, we used to ski Mount Lassen. You know, you probably skied it too.
The old rope toe lift, yeah.
back
when the chalet was there and all that, yeah.
Yeah, so I started skiing there back in like 1964, and we managed to get in high school. We skied more and more up in Tahoe and what have you. So when I went to Berkeley, I realized, I was just looking for stuff to do, and skiing was a chunk of change. Plus, up in the Valley, we're much more. I mean, there's a lot of affluence down. When I was at Berkeley, we weren't rich. My dad did well, but in terms of the world, we weren't really well to do. So to go skiing was a stretch. And as for most of us up there, I knew kids in Chico who skied and Red Bluff and Redding. And so when I went to Berkeley, all of a sudden, this one guy came back from somewhere and he had a surfboard in his car. I go, "What are you doing?" And he goes, "I'm surfing." And I'm like, "Holy smokes. You guys surf?" And he showed me under the Golden Gate Bridge, Fort Point and Dead Man's and all these spots. So it was my first introduction. And my first thing, I was like, "Holy smokes, this is free. This is essential. I mean, the 50-cent toll for the bridge, but this is free and undiscovered, by the way. Nobody knew anything about surfing in San Francisco. They did, Wise and Pee Wee and a lot of those old Bill Hickey. Jack O'Neill started his first surf shop out in the avenues. So the wetsuit adventure. I went out there. There was not many people doing it at the time. There were people, but it was really very, it was weather related. I enjoyed that. I liked being outside. It's a rush. The sea life is ridiculous. I can tell you so many between sharks and whales. And I mean, I used to surf every day for, 20 years. And then I surf a lot now.
Bill, do you remember the first time you actually, because it's not easy to learn to surf. You know, my brother-in-law taught me. I was fortunate that they moved to Daytona Beach for a stretch and lived there. And the waves there are just so easy, like little teeny waves. You know, so was it, you know, a 7-year-old, it was easy to stand up and, you know, learn to surf. And then when I got back to Southern California to the real waves, it was like, oh, this is a lot harder. It's not an easy thing to do. Do you remember the first wave you actually, you know, got up, stood up and, you know, rode it?
For sure. Yeah. I'd go down to Lindemar at Pacifica. And my first surfboard came. I worked at a restaurant called Charlie Brown's down in Emeryville by the racetrack, and I had an awesome job. I was a waiter. I actually paid for my own college, which was back in the day you could do that. And I worked at Charlie Brown's, and one of the dishwashers had come back from a party and they had found a surfboard. Probably didn't find it, but they had a surfboard and I bought it for like $30, just some big yellow, weird looking surfboard. And I started driving out to Lindemar at Pacific, which is about 30-minute drive from Berkeley. And I just figured it out on my own, except I knew you're supposed to wax the board. And I remember waxing the board the first time I was out. And so I turned it over and started waxing it, right? Fin up. And these guys, what exactly?
Whoops. Wrong side.
Because I was a skier, and I had no eyes. Like I didn't even get. So that's.
Oh, I could see that. Yeah.
That was what a Grammy I was, and so yeah, I started there. I got my first wave in Pacifica. It's an addicting, horribly addicting sport. And back then, nobody knew we had the waves as good as we had. The waves are really good up here. It doesn't break a lot, but when it breaks, like today, this morning was pretty good. It'll break all through the fall and the early winter, but there's about 3 or 4 months a year where it can be one of the best waves in the world. And so we had that with maybe just a handful of guys out on it. And the culture there was really strong. It goes from, like I say, Jack O'Neill, to Jack LaLanne, a bunch of old famous, we've had a number of famous surfers come out of the area. But historically, you know, it was just such an unusual thing. And it wasn't until the early 90s that people really figured out we had waves up there. So it bled into the, I guess, long story short, when I was at Berkeley, we were always trying to figure out wind direction because before the internet, before cell phones. And so I was in the climatology department. So I had access to DIFAX maps is what we used to call them, which were surface maps, upper air charts and things like that, that only pilots would get or NASA had. And so I had access to them through Ormand Grandjean, who is a climatologist. And I started figuring out the wind pattern. So I knew when to go surf. That's now it's easy. Now you just go on Surfline or you make a phone call or you just go on, you Google something and it's there. Back in the day, nobody knew. So I'd show up at Steamer's Lane in Santa Cruz when it'd be 8 to 10 foot perfect. And not people didn't know. They'd figure out by the second day of the swell. So I was really good early on picking out swells. As a matter of fact, it's a very ferociously territorial, like Malibu in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Very territorial crowd up in Northern California. The Point Arena guys were a group. The Marin guys were a group. City guys were a group. And then the Half Moon Bay guys, Jeff Clark and those guys. And then the Santa Cruz guys. We were all different tribes. And we were it was very aggressive, as you know. And it was a time that, yeah, it's hard to express how adventurous it was because we would paddle out in places. We didn't know how many sharks were out there. We didn't know if there were, how big the sharks were, how many there were, how big the swell was. I remember paddling out at Ocean Beach off of a Sloat Avenue. Nobody out. I'm like, oh, it looks good. I paddle out. And you've done this probably, Dave. You get out. And it's like, you're the only guy out, so there's no perspective. But all of a sudden there is because you're out. And it's huge 20, you know, 10 foot faces with 20 foot sets, which is terrifying on a beach break. So
yes,
it was a real sense of adventure. And everybody I know, we used to pull tourists out nonstop at Ocean Beach because Ocean Beach, probably the most dangerous wave in the world. And that's because it's a giant river mouth because of the Golden Gate Bridge and everything drains out through the bridge. Right. And so you get these huge sandbars, makes for great as the current drifts the sand south over the beach, get these awesome, awesome sandbars. But you also get these incredible rip currents in this very cold water from upwelling, which creates the opportunity to become hypothermic within like 15 minutes. So people would go to the beach and would get in to maybe go, you know, they're drinking beers or something. They go and they wade into their waist to go to the bathroom, which happened a lot, and they would get swept out. And so we were the last group of people. So I've saved
a lot.
Yes. And somebody goes, well, you're a hero. I go, no. Every one of us, everybody who's my age saved at least two people. And some people more like five and six I had two that were almost dead. And because there was nobody else out, there was no second defense, no line of defense other than the surfers. So it was an interesting time. And now it's everybody surfs and it's awesome. I was talking to somebody about this morning. I think it's great. I mean, it's nice that everybody surfs because it's more fun and everybody's so pleasant and nice. We weren't pleasant and nice. And everybody is really pleasant and nice. And the more women in the water have made the texture better. You don't get as many waves, but it's nice to see people because it's like fly fishing and the things you love, it ties you into nature and immerses you. And that's nothing better for mankind than to immerse yourself, whether you're fly fishing or mountain biking or surfing.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with retired TV meteorologist Bill Martin. Raised in Paradise, California, Bill went on to a 38-year Emmy-winning career on KTVU in Oakland, California. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with my conversation with Bill Martin. Bill recently retired after 38 years as the Emmy-winning meteorologist for KTVU Channel 2 in Oakland, California. that connection to being in the outdoors, for me as a fly angler, you know, that love of the river, that love of the water, that love of the fish, and everything that depends on that river system, that watershed, it means that you also have that passion to protect it. And that's what worries me, is that we've got a generation of kids growing up that don't have that connection to nature, and that it's hard to instill in them to have that passion to protect it.
I agree. And I think that, and not to bust on the kids, because I'm sure we got busted on when we were kids, for sure, by the World War II veterans.
Certainly.
Yeah, right. But I think that they're so, like, they are very distracted. But I think one of the problems is that in like surfing, I can go on Surfline right now and I can check out Ocean Beach and I can tell you what the swell's doing. I can tell you what the wind, and I can go, oh, it looks really good. Okay. And I go out and I go surf. That's great. But what's missing there today, like, that's what,
figuring it out on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I have a career, because I was figuring out surfing, waves, wind, because surfing is all about conditions. I was figuring it out. And so I built this life because of that, as most of us have, as you were a science teacher, right? I mean, you built a life around watching bugs hatch and understanding the caddis and the pupa. And so I think, yes, that, and I don't know if it's just an evolutionary thing, and maybe it's part of what's supposed to happen, but I do worry the same, in that I think the only thing, and I'm not a religious person really, but I do feel like there's, if all the distractions are keeping us from what's really happening, what's really important, and whatever you want to call it, man, but there's something out there, and we're missing it. And we were closer to it when we were little, because there weren't as many distractions. So although we did have TV, which, you know, three channels.
Yes. I remember it was Channel 12 and Channel 3 from Sacramento. Those were your staples, and 7R from Reading. Okay, let's go back to your TV career. Tell us about how you first got started, your first time on TV.
Well, I abbreviated the story. First thing, TV is one of those things back then, especially, nobody really knew how to do it. In other words, knew how to get into it. It was kind of a weird thing. Even back in the day, you kind of either had to, you couldn't just break in. There were, you probably remember some of this too, but it wasn't, you had to have, you know, some kind of an angle and to get in. And so I was a meteorologist, a real meteorologist. And so I started going around and knocking on doors. I went up to Chico. I did get hired up at KHSL, but then before I got hired the week before, I got asked to work at Channel 50. So they were simultaneous. I almost ended up in Chico. So I started out this little TV station at KFTY in Santa Rosa. And like I said, the Bay Area could see us. And so the news directors, a lot of them lived in Marin County. So they'd see me night after night for about a year. And they go, I was, interestingly enough, I was pretty good for not knowing anything about television. And I was pretty good because I really was fascinated. I liked weather. It interests me. You can probably hear it. I mean, I talk about it. I really like it. And so that worked. Apparently, that was in a time when puppeteers and magicians and comedians were doing the weather. And all of a sudden, here's this guy that shows up who's not that. So the Bay Area sort of grabbed onto that, because it was my timing was good. So I went to CBS in San Francisco, worked there for, I think I did weekends for a year. And then I ended up at Channel 2, which is that blowtorch station out of Oakland, which is huge and was massive. I got there, 38 years ago, and built the weather department, because there wasn't a weather department at all. As a matter of fact, the newsroom was fascinating, because the newsroom had won a ton of Murrows and, just Emmys and whatever, and was nationally known for its really good reporting. But they didn't have a weather guy. They had a comedian, a puppeteer guy who was awesome, Dialing for Dollars, Pat McCormick. But they didn't have one. And so the fights and struggles I had once they hired me to get into the newscast, I had to make a pitch every day, because it's an hour-long newscast. You got 20, 30 people working on it. And I go, they only got like, 44 minutes to sell, to use for news. The rest was advertising. And so I had to sell weather to them in every news meeting. And so I finally convinced them that weather was worth the lead story, whatever. So I slowly, that was my, one of my great accomplishments was getting Channel 2 to acknowledge that we can, that weather is viable. Other stations were doing it, but Channel 2 was that hardcore of a news station. I worked with so many people that were really, really talented, but I just got, I got swept into it. And because I was so different, the move is to get, surround yourself with people who are doing the things you want to do and that are good and that are better than you, and you will get pulled along. And that's what happened to me. I just kept getting pulled along by some of the legends in broadcasting and actually being told that, hey, you got kind of this unique thing because you're this. And so I was made aware that my skill set, being a real meteorologist, because nobody, hey, I'm telling you right now, on TV today, they're just reporting the weather, which is fine. But I was actually a real meteorologist. Now there are some real meteorologists on TV, but it's so just it's do the leg. Yeah, it's rare. And so I was a rarity. I was a rare bird in a market that was thirsty for environmental and weather news.
Well, if I can step in and give you my take on you, is that what I think made you great and makes you great is that there's a genuineness about you that comes across on camera. Growing up in the entertainment industry on the sidelines, my mom was in it. You always heard this thing, the it factor, you know, somebody either has it or they don't. And the people that have it, those are the stars. Those are the people that shine. And you have it. You have that just, you know, that magnetic personality that, you know, just makes you enjoy watching it. You know, it's like you're the kind of person that when you're on and you're talking, I start to smile. It's you just bring that presence. And that's not, you know, that's a gift. And that's just something wow. that you have. But also, and I think this is what's wrong, why I can't watch local TV weather hardly at all. It's so bad. Is that there are people that just want to be on TV, and God love them, you know, that's what they want to do, good. And some of them do an okay job, but they don't have the passion for meteorology and the love of weather and the understanding. And I think that's what, you know, that's what makes to me, and you can comment on this, a great TV meteorologist, especially in a local market like the Bay Area or Sacramento or, you know, even Chico, Redding, is that they understand the nuances of place, because you have to live somewhere and see these weather patterns over time to kind of get a sense of, oh, this is what usually happens when this is going on.
Yeah. Wow. You put that really well. You know who does that? Who's awesome? Who you guys all know? I'll bet you know who I'm going to say.
Mark Finan.
Mm-hmm. Mark Finan. Mark is awesome. He is, I think he's better than I am. He's just, because he's really married himself to the community. I had a rougher task because I have such a high, you know, a lot of counties, a lot of people, and it's hard to address everybody. Whereas Mark had a more homogenous group. And in the valley, you guys are kind of, you know, you think about the foothills, you think about the rivers. So he really, and he did, he cares and really, and so I can't say enough nice things about Mark. We're not even really friends. I just like, I watch his stuff and I go, oh, you're awesome. But I,
he also has a YouTube channel, by the way. And
he does. I think he actually inspired me.
Between the two of you, I watch that. That's my go-to source, is your channel and his. What I love about Mark is that he'll show you the models and go through them, and then he'll say,
yes.
In his Mark Finan voice, you know, I think this may be overdoing it a little bit. And that's based on experience.
He's a strong scientist. He's a strong scientist. He really is. I think super highly of him. And my Bill Martin West Coast Weather YouTube page is, it kind of falls in the middle. It's a little more, hey, look, there's a cumulonimbus cloud. Oh, here it is on the radar. Look how it looks here. Whereas I'm trying to be a little more TV, because and Mark's like, no, we're going to just dig. Mm-hmm. And he does. Like, he pulled up the sounding the other day, and I'm like, that is, you know, the yes. radio sounds. And I go, that's awesome. You know, that's a big move. That's a big move to do.
And he's so good at explaining it to you.
Yes. He's my favorite meteorologist by far.
He's amazing. And another thing that you have in common, he's had love for nature. The guy is a nature photographer. He's just got this, you know, this love for the natural world. And that, you know, that comes across, that curiosity about nature is what, you know, that's what makes a scientist. What is science? It's wanting to understand nature.
He walks the walk, and he, yeah, and he delivers. Now, if you want to get a good master's class in how to do broadcast television without having to do broadcast television or YouTube, or whatever, just get a job waiting tables. I waited tables for 5 years at Charlie Brown. So I was at Cal 5 years. I needed an extra year, but I waited tables. I waited on so many people and I talked to so many different people and it was generally fun. I loved it, but I'd watch their eyes because really ultimately as a waiter, what you're doing is you're trying to get their money, right? And so I'd try to get their attention and I wanted them to be happy, which is, that's all fair. It's a strong agreement. And so I could watch people and I got really good at watching their eyes. And when I'd tell a story or let's say I'd go through the menu, and this is a pet peeve of mine, but like when you watch weather guys on TV now, a lot of them, most of them, they do this move. They're like the airline stewardess who's showing you how to put the seatbelt on. They just roll some maps. They kind of want to woo you with how much they know. And they really are just spewing, they're just saying a script.
It's scripted.
And when you wait table, when I was waiting tables, I learned, oh, so if I'd get up and start talking about the special, we got the chicken cordon bleu with the cheese, and people's eyes would glaze. I'd watch in real time and I go, oh, they don't want to hear. You know what they want to hear? They want to hear the Cal student who's got a midterm in the morning say, hey, you know what I get on my break? I get the chicken cordon bleu. The cook puts extra cheese in there. Honest to God. That my tips would be huge. They had fun. I had fun. And that was how I learned how to communicate on TV was like, yeah, that's where people don't want to hear what I know, how it's made. They really want to hear how it's going to impact them or something they can remember, something they can grab onto. They're not dumb. And that's the other thing about the Bay Area market. It's California in general, it's a smart TV market. It really is. So, I mean, I covered a lot of ground there, but the waiting tables, if you ever want to get really good at dealing with people in any way, just wait tables for a couple years and work at it hard like I did. And you'll learn. I learned a lot.
Solid advice from Bill Martin. Okay, let's jump forward a bit and we're back and talk about, you had a pretty neat honor. You got to meet a cool president, President Obama.
He was cool.
You got to meet him. Tell us about that.
Well, it was back, I don't know, it must have been 14 years ago. I can't remember how long ago it was now, but they'd released some new climate report. And at that point, I think the global temperatures were increasing at a higher rate than that had been anticipated. And so the White House, Panetta and those guys were, you know, went out in the country and they got like me, Al Roker, Janice Huff, Christian Zee, and I think two others. So they just grabbed a bunch of, I think they went for the biggest markets. Because it was just obviously we had meetings with the president and his science staff, but they already had their minds made up on what they were going to say, right? We were just, they said we were being consulted. I'm not so sure we were being consulted as opposed to just, you know, hey, let's get a photo op, which is fine because, you know, it's all good, but he was awesome. He was awesome. He's whether you voted for him or not, he's a really smart guy. We had some good chats. He's a surfer he grew up in Hawaii, went to Punahou on the south shore of Oahu. But just a really awesome guy. And we hung out in the White House for a couple of days and just, you know, hanging out with the science advisors was cool. But it was back when TV was, you know, that we were, again, it was really before the internet got big and we were able to, that's how you got the word out. Now, because of all the opportunities and all the platforms, there's a million ways to get the noise out. And sometimes it is just noise, which is a drag. But it was a different time. Yeah.
And what's your take on what's going on right now with like NOAA and the National Weather Service? Because that really concerns me, seeing those really brilliant people who do important work 24/7, 365 to keep us safe. You know, seeing cuts to that just really infuriates me.
Well, I think what's most worrisome, Dave, is the weather balloon soundings. This is actual tangible. They've cut back a little bit, and I don't know the exact map. But you know, airports and some ships at sea, but like SFO, San Jose, Redding, Oakland, they launch weather balloons twice a day. All of our weather models come from those weather balloons. So there's some satellite derived data, but most of it is a weather balloon. Just goes up and it goes through the atmosphere. It's a radio sound and it sends back temperature, dew point, wind direction, wind speed, blah, blah, blah. It sends back all this data and it does it at every level of the atmosphere until the balloon can't measure anymore. So in the morning, they sent some up this morning at 5 a.m. from all the airports around the United States. That's how you build the computer model. So that's your input. So if you cut back on those balloon launches, you're cutting back on the inputs. And we already, the weather is all about inputs. And we don't have, you know, the Northern California has what, 4 weather inputs? Are you kidding me? For the Bay Area, right? So it's already light. But if you're pulling back some of these, I think the Eureka station was talking about, they're actually talking about really, I think, cutting that, the station, or maybe it was Arcata, but either way, you cut back on data in the numbers, you're going to have real problems. And the models are used by everyone. So that's a real concern. You know, I'm an environmental guy. No matter how you feel about the planet and climate change, whether you think it's anthropomorphic or not, is it such a bad idea to conserve?
After a short break, we'll be back for more with our guest, Bill Martin. Bill recently retired after an award-winning career as a television meteorologist in the San Francisco Bay Area on KTVU Channel 2. I'm Dave Schlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our fun visit with Bill Martin, the recently retired Emmy-winning meteorologist for KTVU Channel 2 in Oakland, California. You were involved in some really huge stories. Some of them are very tragic. You covered the Oakland Hills fire back in the day. That was one of your early ones. The tsunami in 2011 in Japan. I remember watching you talk about that and just your expertise coming across that you understand here's why this is happening, because most people don't really truly understand what causes a tsunami. And then, of course, the campfire, which, you know, burned down our childhood homes. Tell us about, you know, what it was like covering some of those huge stories.
Well, the first one you mentioned, one of the ones you mentioned, the tsunami, was stunning, and I'll never forget that night. Only because that we were doing the 10 o'clock news. It was years ago, obviously, and at that time of the day for us, it was morning, or it was still light. Pardon me, in Japan, and so I was just finished weather, and I went into the newsroom real quick before we do the good night. And it's a regular night, no big deal. And I look on one of the feeds. We, in the old days, again, this is before the internet had really taken off. And I could see on the feeds, one of the wires coming in, it was just straight video. I'm looking at this thing going, holy smokes, it's... And now you have to understand, at Berkeley, I was a climatologist and I had a lot of geology and geography and oceanography. So I knew a lot about tsunamis. And I go, well, no one's ever really seen one in real time. And so I wasn't even sure what I was looking at. And then I realized this is a tsunami being recorded from live cameras. One was a traffic camera. They were shooting traffic for a Japanese TV station, and they're shooting some of the famous shots you've all seen. And I'm watching it. I get chills talking about it, watching the ocean come up. We'd never seen that. I studied that and dreamt about them and wondered about them. And yeah, there's this one picture from Hilo in 1955 when they had one, but it was a still, you know, the still shot, you know that.
I know that shot. Mm-hmm. The lighthouse with the wave crashing around it. Yep.
That's the only one I ever saw. And here I am watching it live in real time, and we're going off the air. And I go, no, no, we can't go off the air. And everybody's like, what are you talking about? I go, this is monumental. And so now you got producers and directors and editors and stuff. They're not questioning me, but they're like, what are you talking about? I go, no, no, we got to. And so they did stay on, and we stayed on, you know, for another couple of hours taking live pictures and all. But I remember the awe in seeing like you all saw when the Indonesia earthquake or the tsunami, when you see something like that, and I, again, we, no one's ever had ever seen anything like that in real time. And I was watching it in real time because we were on the West Coast, the East Coast guys were asleep. So we were on it early, and that was stunning. The other one that it hits close to home with you, there's obviously the campfire, which I was up on that, which was just biblical in terms of seeing the flames. And I had an experience on that. I'll make it quick because I love this story. But I was up on just kind of before the Paradise sign on Skyway because mm-hmm. I grew up there. And so
may it be all its name implies.
Yeah. Craig Clemens was on. He's the San Jose State fire weather meteorology head of the department. They were up on Pence. And so we were talking the whole time. He's a good friend. He's like the foremost expert on fires. He says, I've never seen like this. I go, well, come over here to Skyway because we can get all the way into town because Pence had been, you know, it's a 2-lane road.
Right.
You can't really, right. It was just a mess. But at that, this time Skyway was still, so we drove all the way up to the Paradise sign. Basically everything's on fire. And I'm watching this inflow in a fire. So when the fire burns, if you Google Bill Martin campfire
after the show,
yeah, there's a you'll see me doing a stand up, and behind me are this wall of flames, and you can't see the flames. And I thought it was maybe quarter mile back, but it was literally about 50 yards away, and the air was flowing into this thing, and as the air flowed in, I heard this whoosh go by. And I'm like, because the reason air flows in is because the heat's rising, right? It's a thermal low. So the heat's rising and the air is coming in at the surface to fill in that low. The cold air wants to go to the warmer air. And so I hear this whoosh go by and it's like, what was that? It went right by my ear. It was an owl. Now, you've heard it. If you've ever heard an owl, you don't hear him, but you hear him. It's weird.
Yeah.
There's right. There's this sound. And so he was about chest to waist high and he was doing transects back and forth. And I'm like, next thing I hear is this crunching, scurry, scurry. Mice, rodents, whatever was in that brush was moving out of the brush. And this apex predator, horned owl, was perusing. And it was just this moment in time. Just, you can picture, I was the only one there, me and John, the cameraman. The fire trucks had all left. We had to evacuate that spot in 5 minutes. But at this one click in time, hearing the owl, seeing the owl, hearing the rodents, and just watching these flames and just being in awe. Like, I'm still in awe. I can't, just even talking about it. And then the third thing that was terrifying to me that happened up to you guys was the Orville thing.
Yes, the spillway.
Yeah, we watched them build the dam, Dave, right? I'm sure you went up there and watched it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we. My dad had taken me up there in the 60s, and he said, I remember him saying it, I was a little kid, he goes, hey, you know that the spillway is the area that had that trouble with, that was compromised, that was there, the emergency overflow is essentially on the north side of the dam. And that, he said, when they're putting it in, he goes, if that ever happens, we're in big trouble. Well, I'm watching it on television, same thing, and I'm watching the overflow, they're getting chipped away with the concrete. I'm also had enough natural disaster classes to know that dam, if it breaks, is going to be catastrophic beyond what we're projecting, from how much water that dam holds. And so I'm watching it in real time, and it was hard to do because I was worried the whole dam. I really thought if that overflow cuts anymore, if it keeps raining, that whole dam's going to go. And I think it would have. If you know anything about structural geology and whatever, it was very fortunate it didn't. And that was terrifying because I was worried about what could have happened. Of course, they had evacuated Orville at that time, but it wasn't even about Orville. It was about Marysville, about Yuba City, about parts of Sacramento.
Yeah, that was truly, truly frightening time. In the aftermath of the campfire, did you get it? I hate to ask you this, but I had the same experience where I went up in December after, and I tried to find a single home that I had either lived in, rented, or even visited friends. And of course, for me, there were a lot of those, a lot of places, my friends' homes. I couldn't find a single place that I had ever been inside of that was still left. And I looked and I looked. And I know Paradise really, really well because I delivered newspapers for the Paradise Post for a couple of years. So I know every nook and cranny of that town. What was it like for you when you went back and saw your childhood home gone?
It was... the thing that struck me most, Dave, was, first of all, like you said, hard to find anything, not just within the address, but the neighborhood. Like everything looks so different when it was gone, when the trees were gone, when you take those trees out of the, you know, that were there and the landmarks that you don't know.
The landmarks are gone. Yeah.
Yeah. So all I had left of the high school was still there. The junior high was still there. So that's that, you know, for the, like, okay, there's the high school, there's junior high and everything else. I'm like, oh, you know, like the Adventist church, I used to live right off Chapel Lane. So that huge Adventist church behind me thing was a monument to Adventists everywhere. And the thing was gone. And it's, I watched them build that too. But so it was just, it was kind of overwhelming. The biggest thing for me and the hardest thing is knowing that a lot of people who live there, the families, the legacies, they didn't move, you know, they didn't move back.
Displaced, right? So, completely displaced.
Yeah, completely displaced. And there's, I have a bunch of friends, as you do too, who still live up there and they work really hard and they do a great effort at keeping the community a community, because in a place like Paradise or Chico or Red Bluff, you want the generations. That's what a community is. And if you take that away, and I think that's the hardest part, is seeing it turn over like that and not, and the locals not really able to or wanting to go back.
Yeah, it's just so difficult, so difficult to see. One thing I will say though is what I always loved about Paradise wasn't necessarily the houses but I did love the people and my friends and family, but I loved nature there. And it was really quite awe-inspiring just a month later to see new growth.
Yeah.
And some just green things growing, thinking, you know, nature's going to rebound a lot faster than humans will.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about a little bit of a right turn here, but I'm so stoked about Klamath, the river, right?
Oh, the dam removal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you been up there?
I haven't been up there, but we've done several shows about it. And it is promising to see what's going on there and to show what can happen when, you know, we start to work with nature instead of against it.
Well, and I'm assuming, you know, this spring is going to be awesome. I think, I'm guessing, right? The bio, you know, just that old dead scar of a reservoir is going to be, should be covered with life and plants and
new growth.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting. They did that up in, was it Kennewick? Remember the dam up in Washington State where it was on the Columbia?
I think so. Yeah, I vaguely remember that. Yes.
And they pulled it out and the Chinook salmon hadn't run up. They'd been there 100 years or something. And they were like, well, the Chinook will be back in like 10 years. And they were back like 6 months later.
they're seeing the same thing on the Klamath. Well, before we let you go, Bill, you've retired from being a TV meteorologist, but not from being a super cool dude. You got that awesome YouTube channel that's, I know, is going to get better and better. And one of the things I love about it, by the way, it's not just weather. You give that, but you also get a tour de force of, you know, just beautiful views of nature up and down the state. And I like how you do a more global view of things. We're like, here's what's going on in Southern California. Let's look at the surf, you know, in La Jolla, and let's check it out, you know, on the North Coast. And here's Shasta. Isn't this awesome? You know, it's like, look at these lenticular clouds. So that you get that wonderful dose of nature from that.
Thank you. It's kind of a love letter to California. Cause like I said, I'm fifth generation and that's what I do. And that's how, if I could do weather on TV, that's how I would have done it on TV.
And what are some of the future plans you have, Mr. Martin?
Well, I have another business I started. I think I mentioned it to you before, but it's weather applied metrics. And it's a little bit off the nature thing, but I got together with the San Jose State guys, a couple of Berkeley guys. And we built a company that we work with Major League Baseball. And if you've ever watched a Major League Baseball game, you'll see the arrows, the vectors, you'll see the wind. That's us. That's my company. So yeah. And we just started tennis and we're doing NFL. So that's, it's weird. I know it sounds like I'm a businessman. It's I invented it, but I'm so happy that I kind of got business guys to do business. Yeah, it's really, it really is. The most interesting thing, Dave, is that every stadium has a climate. And once you, it's like I'm being on a river fishing, you know where the fish are, right? Well, this, because the current, the flow, and you know, and the different flows change, the fish will be somewhere a little different. Well, that's what we do in stadiums. We build CAD models of stadiums, all every stadium. And then we run CFD, computational fluid dynamic models through those CADs for every possible wind degree and wind speed. And then it's a lookup table and it works amazingly. So it's really been fun. And I enjoy it. I enjoy working with the athletes, but I also enjoy, I've enjoyed kind of coming up with it. And now I have a business crew that's kind of doing all the business stuff.
Very, very cool. Well, Bill, it's been a joy to talk to you. Your passion for nature and the and weather and just enjoying being in the outdoors, it's infectious. And everybody can learn a lot from a guy like you about how to live your best life. Thanks for joining us and sharing a little bit of your remarkable journey from paradise to the Bay Area and beyond. Bill Martin, it's just been great.
I appreciate it, David. I would say this, like what you guys are doing there is awesome. I love the, again, like I said, this platform you have and your work's good. Like I watched a couple, I've listened to a couple of the episodes. I haven't listened to all of them, obviously, but it's really...
That'd take a while.
It would, but it's, you do awesome stuff. So I was really excited. I appreciate you taking the time to reach out and I appreciate it. I love it. And I love with that North Valley and that it, in the Valley, in the state, but I do think it's so, for me to hear a voice from there is what really makes a huge difference. I love that. Because you guys didn't have a megaphone, and now you do.
Thanks again to our guest, Bill Martin. This was such a fun conversation for me personally, since Bill grew up in Paradise, California, and we both have many friends and influences in common because I grew up there too. You can get a wonderful daily dose of weather forecasting and a look at some of the most beautiful places that Bill loves in California on his eponymously named YouTube channel. I highly recommend it. It's fun and informative, a great way to start your day with a really cool vibe from a truly awesome dude. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.